Hello and welcome. When the United States got involved in World War I, Senator Hiram Johnson made a comment that has been widely quoted ever since. He said, "The first casualty when war comes is truth." Well, the accuracy of that remark has been confirmed and reconfirmed many times since it was made nearly a century ago. And all too often, the bigger the war, the greater the level of official and media distortion, deceit, and lies. Today I'm going to take a look at falsehood in wartime during the First and Second World Wars, by far the two most destructive and horrific conflicts of the past 100 years. I'm relying in part on a book I recommend entitled The First Casualty. As the author makes clear, the title is based on that remark by Senator Johnson. The book is written by Philip Knightley, an outstanding author, historian, and journalist. The book received much well-deserved praise when it was published in 1975. Various editions of the and printings of the book appeared in the years since then. And although the book was first published more than 30 years ago, copies are still available in many public libraries. World War I was what they call a total war. That is, Britain, France, the United States, Russia, Germany, the countries involved in the First World War, mobilized tremendous resources under government control to prosecute the war to the best of their ability. For example, in the United States, the U.S. government took control of the entire U.S. railway system. Censorship was imposed in a very rigorous way in all the countries involved in the conflict. And along with this mobilization of resources for war was also a tremendous propaganda campaign carried out by all the sides in the war. But the Allied propaganda was not only more exaggerated, but more enduring, more durable, because the Allies won the war. And so the Allied propaganda had a much longer life and had a bigger impact than propaganda by the Germans or the Austro-Hungarians and the other sides that lost the war. The war was launched by on the Allied side with a great deal of fanfare about how this was a war for civilization itself. During the conflict, American, British, and French newspapers, intellectual leaders, and politicians portrayed the Germans in the most exaggerated and vilifying way. As Knightley points out, an article that appeared in the London Daily Mail in 1914 referred to and talked about the German emperor, the Kaiser Wilhelm, in just one article as a lunatic, a barbarian, a madman, a monster, a modern Judas, and a criminal monarch. All this in just one single article. Throughout the war years, British and American and French newspapers and politicians portrayed the Germans as only slightly better than the hordes of Genghis Khan. They were portrayed as rapers of nuns, mutilators of children, destroyers of civilization. The Financial News, a leading London newspaper, in one editorial, an editorial published in 1915, claimed that the German emperor had ordered German airmen to make special efforts to kill the children of the Belgian king, that double rewards were being paid to German submarine crews for sinking ships carrying women and children, and that the German emperor had personally ordered the torturing of three-year-old children and specified the tortures to be inflicted. Along with this campaign by the Allies portrayed the Germans as barbarians, as Huns, as beasts, was also a campaign to portray the Allied war aims in the most noble way possible. When the United States declared war against Germany in April of 1917, President Wilson in Washington declared that this wasn't a war against a country that was threatening America, but rather a war to make the whole world safe for democracy. That's what he said in his Declaration of War speech. It was portrayed in the American and British media as a war that was so horrific that it would be a war that would end all war. A war, a final war in human history. H.G. Wells, the British writer, novelist, who was the author of The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds, two books that were later made into movies, declared that the war was inevitable because Germany was so wicked and so evil. But out of the war would come a lasting peace. Wells said that this would be the war that will end war. Expectations were made very, very high for the public in the United States, Britain, and France, and the world about the outcome of this conflict. One of the most lurid and sensational atrocity stories of the Allies during the war was the claim that the Germans had built a factory for turning the corpses, the bodies of dead soldiers, into glycerin for munitions. This German corpse factory story first emerged in 1917 in an article in the London Times, but it became a very, very widely reprinted, widely relayed story of German atrocity conduct, atrocious German conduct during the First World War. Now, the Germans protested that the claim was loathsome and ridiculous, but that didn't stop it from being widely repeated and widely propagated in the Allied media at the time. The claim that the Germans were boiling down the corpses of dead soldiers to be made into glycerin for munitions persisted throughout the war years and for years afterwards. It wasn't until 1925, years after the war ended, that the British government finally admitted officially that the corpse factory story was untrue. This was acknowledged in a statement made in the London House of Commons. But of course, by that time, the war atrocity story had done its work. The war was over, of course, by that time. One point that Knightley makes in his book is just how misleading reporting was during the First World War about the scope of the conflict, how horrific and how horrible it was in cost, in human cost. He writes, "It cannot be too strongly emphasized that the British public and the French and the German did not know or understand the full extent of the casualties until after the war." He says, "The figures of casualties during the First World War defy real comprehension. Who can comprehend that 500,000 Frenchmen were lost in the first 4 months of the war, 1 million lost by the end of 1915, and 5 million by 1918? Who can imagine that the Allies lost 600,000 men in one battle, the Battle of the Somme, and that the British lost more officers in the first few months than in all the wars of the previous 100 years put together?" Knightley points out that in the Battle of Stalingrad in the Second World War, German forces numbered 230,000 men. But in the Battle of Verdun in the First World War, in the Battle of Verdun alone, German losses were 325,000 killed or wounded. Knightley also points out that for every British serviceman killed in the Second World War, three were killed in the First World War. British losses in the First World War of servicemen killed was three times the number lost in the Second World War. He also mentions that in one battle, the defeat at Mons, even though it was a terrible conflict, a terrible battle, with huge losses, that this was the news of this battle, the scope of this battle, was kept from the British public. He also talks about the Battle of Frontier between August 14th and 25th, 1914, a German victory that wiped out about 300,000 French soldiers, or nearly 25% of the combatants. This is at the outbreak of the conflict in August of 1914. It was a rate of wastage never equaled in the rest of the fighting on any front. And yet, this German victory, this battle in which 300,000 French soldiers were wiped out, as Ed Knightley points out, remained completely unreported in Britain until after the war was over. This was an enormously horrible story and loss, but it remained unknown in Britain until after the war was over. That's just one indication of the level of censorship, media manipulation, and propaganda carried out during the First World War. He also writes about the Battle of the Somme in July of 1916. He calls it perhaps the most bloody defeat in Britain's history. But in this conflict, on the first day of the battle, on July 1st, 20,000 men were killed. It was a battle across a 20-mile front. And the Allied losses in the Battle of the Somme were 600,000 dead, wounded, and missing. The only Allied achievement of the Battle of the Somme was to gain a few kilometers of ground. But, as he points out, Allied reporting about this horrible battle and this huge bloody defeat was bland and innocuous in the British newspapers. Instead, reports appeared in the British newspapers. He quotes one that says, in the aftermath of this terrible loss of 20,000 men, one British journalist wrote, "It is on balance a good day for England and France. It is a day of promise in this war." Well, the British journalist who wrote that later excused himself with the explanation, quote, "I have had to spare the feelings of men and women who have sons and husbands still fighting in France." Another journalist who covered the First World War later wrote, "I was thoroughly and deeply ashamed of what I had written, for the good reason that it was untrue." One of the reasons why there was such great disillusion at the end of the First World War by virtually everybody across the board in the United States, Britain, France, and Germany was that the promises and pledges and propaganda made by the British, Americans, and French about the nature of the conflict proved to be lies. This was confirmed in 1917 and 1918, because the overthrow of the Tsarist government in 1917 in February, and then the takeover of the government by the Bolsheviks, by the communists, in October of 1917, in the so-called October Revolution, led to the publication by the new communist government of secret treaties that had been worked out, negotiated between the Tsarist regime in Russia and the Allied governments. A British journalist for the Guardian newspaper scooped all others by making public the texts and the details about these secret Allied agreements. He revealed in The Guardian that the agreements secretly made by the Allies, including one giving France a free hand in Western Europe on condition that Russia had a similar hand in Poland. He also revealed a cynical bribe to Romania if she would enter the war by the British and French governments. The Romanians were promised chunks of territory in what later became Yugoslavia, in the Bukovina, and in Transylvania if they would agree to join the war on the Allied side. There was another agreement, secret Allied agreement, splitting Persia or Iran between Britain and Russia. And finally, there was the infamous Sykes-Picot agreement between the British and the French to divide much of the Arab world among the Allies. Now, these secret agreements were in crass contradiction to the claims being made by the Allied governments, by the British, French, and American governments, that World War I was a noble conflict being fought for democracy, freedom, and self-determination. In fact, the British, the French, were involved in a cynical carving up of territory of the defeated powers among themselves. And the revelations of these secret agreements led in the aftermath of the war to a tremendous disillusionment and disappointment, a tremendous revulsion in the United States, Britain, and France about the conduct of the war. And that led in the 1920s and 30s to a tremendous anti-war feeling, especially in the United States, and the passing of the neutrality laws to try to keep the United States out of a similar conflict if one should arise later. One American journalist who reported in World War I was a man named George Seldes. Seldes wrote a memoir published in 1935 entitled One Man's Newspaper Game. And in this, he looked back upon his role as a journalist in World War I. He wrote this: "Of the first war years, I will say just this. I made a total fool of myself when I accepted as true the news reports from New York and Europe, which by their volume and repetition overwhelmed what little objective intelligence I had." Seldes talks about the incident of the sinking of the British liner Lusitania, which was a very important propaganda, which was exploited propagandistically to get America involved in World War I. He writes, "All the Allied reports told of a dastardly and heinous crime against civilians, but the German news bureau said the ship carried munitions. Today, the sworn statement of the former collector of the port of New York gives the exact character and tonnage of those munitions. But in 1915, I played the Allied side. I used all the stories of German atrocities, including the Baltimore Preacher's so-called unimpeachable account of the crucifixion of Canadian soldiers by the enemy. In short, in common with about 90% of the American press, I had become a blind but willing agent of the powerful and finally victorious Allied propaganda machine. At that time, we considered ourselves the most favored, and on our return we found ourselves the most envied of mortals, and the journals which printed our stories boasted of the fact that their own representatives had been at the fighting front. I now realize that we were told nothing but bunkum, that we were shown nothing of the realities of the war, that we were, in short, merely part of the great Allied propaganda machine whose purpose was to sustain morale at all costs and help drag unwilling America into the slaughter. We all more or less lied about the war." That's from the memoir of George Seldes, one American journalist of World War I, in his memoir published in 1935. Well, similar distortions, similar misrepresentation also characterized the Second World War. But the situation was also different in many ways. As Knightley points out, the Germans, by this time, had learned a great deal of the effectiveness of Allied propaganda during the First World War. And Germany built up, during the Third Reich era, a very impressive and well-organized journalistic and propaganda apparatus under the direction of Joseph Goebbels. Now, it's often said that Joseph Goebbels was the so-called master of the big lie. But the truth is that the effectiveness of German presentation during World War II was, to a large measure, due to the fact that Goebbels emphasized the importance of being truthful in propaganda and not lying. He avoided the kind of exaggerated and distorted propaganda that the Allies had engaged in during the First World War. And German reports, as Knightley and others make clear and have made clear, were far more accurate, far more faithful to reality and truth than were Allied reports and claims made during the Second World War. He cites an example from 1940, during the so-called phony war between France and Britain on the one hand and Germany on the other. He said that during this period, American newspapers, even the American magazine Fortune, complained during this time that American newspaper readers were being fed a tissue of half-truths, edited information, poisoned statistics, doped stories, rumors, and rumors of rumors provided by the British and the French. The British and American coverage of the war during this period was characterized by a very high level of deceit and falsehood. And journalists quickly found that the German reports about the fighting were much more accurate, far more truthful than those of the British and the French. He mentions, for example, that American headlines based on French reports showed that the French forces were advancing almost daily, but by the end of the week had gotten nowhere. British and French reports also reported a second big battle in the North Sea, that water was pouring through the breaches in the Belgian dikes, that British and French forces had pierced the German defensive line, the so-called Siegfried Line, that German and British planes had fought an air battle over Southend. All of these reports, as Knightley points out, were fairy tales, were untrue. So it's no wonder, Knightley writes, that American newspaper offices turned to their correspondents in Germany to learn what was going on. At this time, of course, the United States was still officially neutral in the conflict, so America had its own journalists stationed in Germany during this period when Germany was fighting against Britain and France. Not only were the German reports more accurate, but the American journalists in Germany were allowed to report much more freely than were American journalists in Britain or France at this time. And the Germans made sure that American journalists were able to make contact with their editors and their publications back in the United States much more easily and quickly than was the case with American journalists stationed in Britain or France. Well, we'll take a break at this point and continue in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was contrasting how American journalists operated in Germany during 1939 and 40, on the one hand, and the scriptures under which they had to operate in Britain and France during this same period of time. Philip Knightley, in his book The Final Casualty, talking about war reporting and propaganda in a number of wars, has a whole chapter on this particular subject, in this particular issue. He writes that journalists operating out of Germany were able to do their job much more freely than were journalists operating in Britain and France, and that unlike the situation in Britain and France at this time, correspondents operating in Germany did not have their reports and dispatches censored. The Germans were proud of this freedom of reporting that they gave to foreign journalists operating from their lines and in their country. Now, the Germans did, of course, carefully monitor the reports that were sent out and admonished or pressured those journalists who reported things that were untrue or slanted in some very strong way. But having said this, overall, as Knightley says, a war correspondent's difficulties in Britain and France were far greater than in Germany. And as a result, he says, during September, October 1939, and in the months afterwards, about 100 neutral reporters made their way to Berlin to base themselves there. Knightley points out that Germany had learned a great deal from the experience of the First World War. And he writes, quote, "The Ministry of Propaganda, under the brilliant control of Dr. Goebbels, looked after neutral war correspondence via its foreign press department." And he talks about how foreign journalists were pampered and given all sorts of benefits so that they would be more and more inclined to report objectively and truthfully and favorably about the German side of the conflict than was the case in Britain or France. As a result, in 1939 and 1940, American newspapers were dominated by pictures and reports from the German side of the campaign as opposed to the British and French, because the German government did everything it could to make sure that reports going back to the United States and to other neutral countries were dispatched as quickly as possible without any delay and with less restriction than was the case in Britain and France. Knightley points out that as a result of this, there was a tremendous demand in neutral countries, including the United States, for the German reports, which were provided and which were available in much greater abundance than was the case on the Allied side, in the British and French side. And the German correspondents operated on the front lines in a way that was provided much more first-hand and on-the-spot reporting than was the case in with British and French journalists at this time. He also points out that British reports tended to be disbelieved in neutral countries, including the United States, in part because the British reports were often exaggerated or untrue, and also because many people had remembered that British reporting was so inaccurate and exaggerated during the First World War, that there was a large measure of skepticism about British reports because of the great exaggeration and misrepresentation that Britain had engaged in earlier. One of the good examples in which, in the way a story can be spinned in a way that makes the bad look good and white look black, is the reporting and the presentation about the British evacuation from Dunkirk in northern France in May and June 1940. The British and French forces were overwhelmed, and the British forces that were stationed in northern France and Belgium were very soon pushed back to the area around the port city of Dunkirk, and then were evacuated back to Britain. Well, the what grew up around the evacuation was a tremendous propaganda myth. Now, Churchill admitted in the House of Commons that the Dunkirk evacuation was, as he put it, a colossal military disaster. But the British media and other British officials all the same portrayed the evacuation as something of a success. The Daily Mirror, a leading London newspaper, ran a story about the evacuation under the headline, "Bloody Marvelous." And the Sunday Dispatch, another British newspaper, suggested that divine intervention was responsible in helping the evacuation because it implied that God had made the weather better so that the British forces could be evacuated in an area which was often characterized and by fog and poor visibility. In the United States, the New York Times, which was very strongly pro-British in its sentiments and very hostile to Hitler's Germany, was unable to contain its admiration for the British evacuation at Dunkirk. The New York Times wrote, quote, so long as the English tongue survives, the word Dunkirk will be spoken with reverence. For in that harbor, in such a hell as never blazed on earth before, at the end of a last battle, the rage and blemishes that have hidden the soul of democracy fell away. There, beaten but unconquered, in shining splendor, she faced the enemy. Unquote. Well, as Knightley points out in his book, this characterization of the evacuation of Dunkirk is completely untrue. It's essentially a lie. In fact, there was chaos, disorder, confusion, shooting, drunkenness among the British, French, and North African troops that were being evacuated at the time. He points out how one British officer was shot by another as the only way of preventing him from capsizing an already overloaded rowing boat. How one senior officer refused to leave a foxhole he had dug in the sand. How others had to be threatened with being shot for disobeying orders. And how many of the men just simply hurled their rifles away and refused to evacuate in any sort of order, but were in panic. He also points out it was not until the late 1950s, the early 1960s, nearly 20 years afterwards, that a fuller, truer picture of the Dunkirk fiasco began to emerge. He points out that far from the British and French and other forces facing a superior German force, just the opposite was the truth. That actually, the German forces were very inferior in numbers to the French and British forces that were on the beaches or around the Dunkirk harbors. Even in tanks, the Germans had fewer and less powerful tanks than the Allies. That much of the success of the Germans in northern France and with regard to the Dunkirk campaign was due to the tradition-bound short-sightedness of the Allied officers and Allied command. In short, that the portrayal of the Dunkirk evacuation at the time in British and American newspapers was a perversion and distortion of the truth and the reality. Moreover, Knightley talks about how British reporting about the air battle over London in 1940 was wildly exaggerated and inaccurate. the story of the fighting by RAF fighter pilots against the German bombing campaign in 1940 greatly exaggerated the number of German planes shot down. For example, on September 9th, the London Times reported that 107 German planes had been shot down in a raid 2 days earlier. In fact, only 49, less than half that number, had in fact been shot down. On September 15th of 1940, the British Air Ministry announced that 185 German planes had been destroyed, what it called the greatest day in the whole battle. And this was announced also in billboards. The real number of German lost airplanes in this battle was 60. That is less than half the number claimed by the British authorities. The Air Ministry reported that between July 10th and October 31st, 1940, that 2,698 German planes had been shot down. In fact, the number of German planes shot down and lost was 1,733. But this exaggeration was characteristic not only of the reports of German airplanes shot down over Britain, it was also characteristic of the claims made by Churchill in the British House of Commons about German submarines that had been destroyed by the British. Across the board, British claims about German losses and about British losses were greatly exaggerated to portray the situation as well as possible. Moreover, Knightley points out that one of the biggest myths of World War II is that the bombing of civilians was started by the Germans. In fact, it was really started by the British. There had been the Germans were very careful in the Blitz on London to target war-related targets, oil tanks, railway yards, harbors, and so forth, and to avoid civilian targets. Now, there was, however, some bombs did fall accidentally on the city and a part of the east end of London. And the German crews that had mistakenly bombed this were punished by being posted to infantry regiments. And Knightley cites this as evidence and proof that the Germans deliberately tried to avoid bombing civilians during the Blitz campaign. But Churchill seized upon this accident to order the British Air Force to carry out, on August 25th, a reprisal raid on Berlin, in spite of the unanimous advice of the British Air Force Chiefs of Staff not to do so. The attack was carried out, supposedly, the British said, against clearly defined military objectives. But in fact, the British raid was an indiscriminate one and was done to deliberately provoke a escalation of the fighting. Now, Churchill's motive in doing this was an obsession with trying to get America into the war. He needed to frighten public opinion in the United States, including the American president, with the prospect of a German victory. And he wanted to create as much outrage in American public opinion as possible to move American public sentiment in favor of entering the war on the side of Britain. And this is why, Knightley points out, Churchill and the British were eager to promote the bombing of civilians and to escalate the fighting in the air war between Britain and Germany. He also cites in this regard the myth of the so-called terror bombing of the city of Coventry. Again, the British exaggerated tremendously the German bombing of the city of Coventry. And as Knightley points out, what the Germans did attack was a legitimate military target, one of the keys to the British war effort. And the British bombers damaged 21 important factories, which were essential to the British war effort. This was reported by German journalists at the time who flew with the German Air Force on the attack during these raids. And Knightley praises the German reports as being accurate. But the British media and the British government spinned this as a terror campaign against the city of Coventry. And this was played up in the American media to encourage public opinion to be sympathetic to Britain and hostile to Germany. The British media was subject to censorship during this time. And during a debate in the House of Commons, a question was asked of Prime Minister Churchill about strict censorship of the British media by correspondents who were reporting at that time from the fighting in Italy. Churchill acknowledged this, and he said this: "Such words as desperate ought not to be used about a position in a battle when they are false. Still less should they have been used if they were true." In other words, Churchill admitted about the nature of the severity of British censorship during the war. In his book, Philip Knightley also talks about the nature of the fighting in the Pacific theater, especially between the United States and Japan. He writes that the war in the Pacific, unlike the war on the Western Front in Europe, had strong racial overtones. British and American propaganda encouraged the Allied troops and the public at home to think of the Japanese as apes in uniform, lacking sufficient intelligence to master mechanized warfare, unable to learn to pilot planes because they had been strapped to their mothers' backs as babies and thus lost their sense of balance. The danger of propaganda like this, Knightley writes, is that it dehumanizes the enemy and makes it easier to treat him like an animal whose life and feelings are of little value. It was thus inevitable that atrocities occurred, and they occurred on both sides. In this regard, Knightley mentions incidents of killing of prisoners by American forces in the Pacific. And he talked about how the ears of dead Japanese soldiers were collected by Allied troops in the Pacific. And he gives other examples of atrocities carried out by American, British, and Australian troops against the Japanese. He also reveals how American reporting about the air bombing of Japan was sanitized and distorted. Official communiques claimed that American planes were bombing only military objectives in Tokyo with what it was called pinpoint accuracy. In fact, Knightley points out, the fire raid bombings were indiscriminate and caused more casualties than the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. In Tokyo, he points out, at least 250,000 people were killed and 8 million were made homeless. In one raid alone, on March 10, 1945, American warplanes killed 140,000 people and left 1 million homeless. Now, the full extent and the scope of this kind of indiscriminate terror bombing of and killing of civilians was not revealed to the American public at the time. Knightley also talks about how distorted the reporting was in the Eastern Front. The greatest battles of World War II took place on the Eastern Front between German and Soviet forces. And much of the reporting, and much of the scope of this huge battle was hardly at all reported in the American press at the time. He mentions, for example, that the German army invaded Russia with 3,200 tanks. The Soviet Union, on the other hand, began the war with 20,000 tanks, more tanks than were possessed by the rest of the world put together. The biggest liability and the biggest setback for the Germans, and the reason, the main reason that Germany lost the war, was that Hitler and the Germans greatly underestimated the enormity of the colossal war machine that Stalin and the Soviet Union had built up. He writes about the Battle of Kursk in July 1943, the greatest armored battle in history. Almost nothing of this enormous, colossal battle appeared in the American press. There were fairly detailed reports in the German media at the time, and the Soviet press was very, very heavily censored and distorted. But it wasn't until years afterwards that the full story of this immense battle finally was made public. Knightley also touches, although not in great detail, about the contrast between reporting in the German media and in the other European media about the Katyn Forest Massacre. In 1940, thousands of Polish officers taken prisoners by the Soviets were simply put to death by the Soviet secret police. And the mass grave at Katyn was uncovered in 1943. But the American public was told nothing about the truth of this, and the American media blamed the killings not on the Soviets who carried them out, but instead, and completely untruthfully, blamed them on the Germans. Well, Knightley also talks about the Dresden bombing in February 1945, which was essentially a terror bombing, killing tens of thousands of German civilians in a city with very little military importance. But nothing of that was reported at the time in the American media, and the best reports appeared not only in German newspapers, but in newspapers in neutral Sweden and Switzerland at the time. To sum up World War II, Philip Knightley quotes a Canadian journalist named Charles Lynch, who had been accredited to the British Army for the Reuters News Agency. And he summed up with the words, "It's humiliating to look back at what we wrote during the war. It was crap, and I don't exclude the Ernie Pyles or the Alan Moorheads. We were a propaganda arm of our governments. At the start, the censors enforced that, but by the end, we were our own censors. We were cheerleaders. I suppose there wasn't an alternative at the time. It was total war. But for God's sakes, let's not glorify our role. It wasn't good journalism. It wasn't journalism at all." Unquote. A recent book by the American social scientist and scholar John Mearsheimer is entitled Why Leaders Lie. And he goes in this book in the way in which democratic societies tend to encourage more distortion and deceit about war than do authoritarian states. Now, the reason for this, he says, is that in a democracy, to get people to support the war aims, it's necessary to exaggerate and to embellish the truth in order to portray the enemy as evil as possible and one's own side as good as possible. And no war was that more true than in World War II. Well, I hope you'll join me for our next broadcast. In the meantime, I urge you to check out the IHR website, ihr.org, and to see what many other articles are available on the IHR website dealing with this and similar topics.